Welcome to the Predictable Revenue Podcast, where frontline sales leaders teach you how to build and scale an outbound sales team.
This episode of the Predictable Revenue Podcast is brought to you by SDR Pods. Learn how we can build you a fully equipped sales development team to execute on personalized multi-channel prospecting and book you more meetings at the link below.
Hi guys, welcome to another episode of the Predictable Revenue Podcast. Super excited to be chatting about this topic because it's something that our guest is obviously very knowledgeable in, but it's also something that's close to our hearts here at Predictable Revenue. So a lot of companies have kind of an aversion or kind of a knee-jerk reaction when it comes to outsourcing, or at least not necessarily outsourcing, but actually hiring outside of the nation or the continent that their HQ is based in. But I think, and our guest thinks so as well, if you're not opening yourself up to that possibility, you're missing out on different perceptions, on different cultures, on different skills and capabilities. And also you're missing out on potentially more revenue. So that's our topic today. It's how to manage a sales org spanning two continents and two cultures. My guest is currently the head of sales at Esper, which is a cloud-based enterprise device fleet management platform for managing Android devices via APIs. He has a long history of working in sales, operations. He's an entrepreneur. He's a founder of Minyans, and he still works closely with the University of Washington with their entrepreneur community, or more specifically with the Berks Center for Entrepreneurship. He also did a stint at AppSheet last year, and it was recently acquired by Google. So that's pretty impressive too. Billy Shang, welcome to the Predictable Revenue Podcast.
Thanks, Sarah, for the awesome introduction. Really excited to share about this topic because it's near and dear to my heart. I think it's going to be really applicable for companies who are listening to this podcast because they want an option of bootstrapping. They want to iterate quickly, and they might not have the resources of a VC to hire local talent or expensive talent in the Bay Area. But it's also helpful for companies who are growing quickly, who have VC funding and want to just increase their footprint and be able to scale really rapidly without having a lot of operational costs.
Awesome. Well, I'm really excited to get into it. And something that we chatted about, Billy, offline was that there's a lot of sales content kind of all over the internet, all over LinkedIn, all over the web about the classic SaaS model, the SaaS startup model. There's all this content around SDRs and AEs and what each of their roles are and kind of different strategies that work really well. And as a result, this particular model of like the close working next to each other, close AE SDR model is really ingrained in like the US business culture. We're really used to the idea of having the SDR and the AE work hand in hand, work in the same office. And our idea then is kind of like closed off to potential other possibilities. So tell me a bit about your sales organization and how you guys have kind of subverted that classic model.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think a lot of that classic model stems from actually Predictable Revenue, and it laid the foundation of what we have now. As you said before, when I read books like The Sales Blueprint, it literally has a chapter on this is where your team sits. This is what the office layout should look like. This is where your AEs are. This is where your sales engineers are. This is where your SDRs are. And for us, we try to replicate the intentions of what that's trying to do, which is a really collaborative spirit, but adapt it into a business organizations where we can take advantage of our remote team. For us, our initial SDR hires were in our Bangalore office. And when we first started, we have a large office in Bangalore doing dev, marketing, sales. And then we rolled out this US office, right? Founders are in the US, but they have ties to India. And it made us able to iterate and scale rapidly without having to spend too much on salary and headcount.
Okay. So you guys actually started all your sales in the Bangalore office and then brought it into the US afterwards.
So we started a sales team in Bangalore selling to Bangalore. And when we started the US office almost simultaneously, but we only had one or two AEs, like the first AE that you hire. And we were trying to make a decision of, okay, well, now we have that AE, we know we can close deals. How do we scale up those opportunities? And we had this debate of whether to hire SDRs in India or to hire SDRs here in the US. And this is before we even raise our Series A. So money was tight. We wanted to get some initial quick wins.
Cool. And so that's what you decided to do. You decided instead of having to build that entire SDR team out in the US, you would keep those couple of AEs, but kind of feed them those opportunities via that SDR team in Bangalore.
Absolutely. Yeah. So we, our first four SDR hires were all in Bangalore. And I think it stems from my days as an entrepreneur where we were bootstrapped. We just came out of college. We were doing a peer-to-peer gig economy where we had matched up college students with local mm-hmm. businesses that needed 2-3 hours of work. So you can think of perhaps a local triathlon where they need people handing out water or setting up stations. And for us, because we're bootstrapped, we needed to get the word out. We went on Upwork and we found BDRs or marketing development reps or SDRs. And that was my first foray into working with people from a different country to do a lot of the core business that we have. And I felt like from my prior success with them and based on like the value of how much we're paying in salary versus the leads we could get, I could replicate that with the new team here at Esper.
Okay, awesome. So is that why you chose India then as the place? Were those people that you were working with through Upwork based in India? And that's kind of where you got the inspiration? Or why did you choose to base this team in India out of, you know, all the places that you could have chosen?
Yeah, for us, India, because we had an existing office there. Right. So at least they would have some sort of camaraderie and be able to go into the office. This is pre-COVID and get to hang out with their coworkers, see the engineers. So we felt like it was important, even if we are going to outsource, to have a local office. That's a big tip I have, which is if you do decide to have a remote team, try to hire in the same city so that everybody can at least come together and have that sense of camaraderie. I know it's a little bit difficult now, but that's one thing that really helped our SDRs feel a sense of belonging and feel like they're part of the core team.
Yeah, that absolutely makes sense. And just kind of rewinding even a little bit further, why did you choose India as the location for that initial office? Like that you mentioned that was the first place that you actually had offices. Why Bangalore? Why India for that?
Yeah, so India is going through a big tech, transformation. So when our founders founded the company, our first engineers were from Bangalore and in the Bangalore office. And then we added on top of that, we started hiring in marketing. Companies like Chargebee and Freshdesk have all like built massive empires that have penetrated the US market. And India is a place where we feel like just the tech talent there is on par with a lot of places globally. So. Right. We hired our engineers there, then we hired our marketing team there, and then we had salespeople come on. But it was really the first few engineering hires where we wanted to start building on that.
Awesome. Cool. Okay. Well, let's get in a little bit into this aversion that people do have to the idea of like hiring outside of their own country or outsourcing. Although, as you're saying, actually building an office in that location and then having them all go in there when they can, COVID aside, it's not really outsourcing, right? It's you are just simply building an office in a different country. It's not outsourcing. They are your employees. They're in your offices. But tell me about this stigma that people do kind of have about, or rather the stigma that outsourcing or hiring outside of your own country has. What is the aversion? Where does that stem from?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the two biggest ones right off the bat is communication. And the second one is just image. I'll talk about the first one, communication. There's no question that wherever you learn English and wherever you are speaking English, you have an accent, right? We have a West Coast accent. Maybe I sound really flat. Maybe I sound kind of annoying.
Maybe you've got a Valley Girl accent.
Yeah. and some of these are ingrained into our culture, right? I think even if there's Valley Girl and there's flat West Coast or whatever, people initially trust you based on the first few seconds you hear off the phone. And as you know, Sarah, a lot of what sales is communication. And spending a lot of time in meetings on phone. So the version that most people have is when they hear an Indian accent, they think, oh, maybe this is a scam. Maybe this is a telemarketer. Let me shut off the phone, right? And there's no way around that. That's going to happen, right? People who are going to shut the phone on you because they hear a weird accent are probably the same people who are going to shut the phone on you because they don't want to talk to you in the first place. But I feel like tech has come such a long way with the CEOs and with the diversity across the board, that if you are in a space that's selling to companies who are inclusive, who are in tech, people tend to stay on the phone a little bit longer and look past the accent if your content is great and if what you're saying is relevant. And I think that's what we train our SDRs to do, saying that, yeah, you're going to have people who are going to shut the phone on you because the first thing out of your mouth is not sounding the same as who you're calling. But that's okay, because if our content resonates with people and we can still book meetings, it means that we have a good business model.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, makes sense. And yeah, as you're saying, the people that are probably going to slam the phone down probably weren't going to listen to you even if you didn't have a different accent that they had, or aren't very receptive to the idea of, you know, new anything. So maybe it's okay that you're losing those people on the first call.
Exactly. And then the second one comes to image, right? A lot of people feel like, hey, if a company has an India facing team and US facing team, their technology is not going to be as great. The company is not going to be as well organized. And there's a stigma there. And I think for us, it's about breaking those stigmas and saying that, let's get those early adopters in, especially when you're ramping up. And we want people who are willing to give us a try. The people who have those preconceived notions of this isn't a professional product are probably going to be people who are difficult to please on the first hand. And we'd rather get some quick wins with companies who want to work with us, because the problem that we're solving is really core to the challenges that they're facing.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah, I agree. The kind of idea that the actual output of a team based anywhere except like a European or North American headquarters is very like, it's an archaic belief. And those are the types, if people are really clinging to that belief, they're probably not very innovative as companies. They're not like disruptors. They're not interested in digital transformation and all these things that you guys are going to offer, or probably a lot of companies that are, you know, expanding their headquarters globally are offering. So yeah. Makes sense that you'd want to go for the early adopters, as you mentioned, those people that are kind of on the forefront and open to trying new things and looking for new solutions. So, okay, in terms of hiring abroad, of course, there is a big impact on the bottom line. That's another appealing factor about hiring abroad. So tell me about the unit economics here. Tell me about what the financial benefit is.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's say an SDR here in Seattle, right? They range anywhere from, if they're right out of college, 45,000 to, if they're more senior, about 75, maybe some companies are pushing 80 for a base salary, right? And then if you double the base and count that as your OTE, that's typically what you're expecting. In India, you can get an SDR for about a third or a fourth of that price. So you can get people for $10,000 all in, their OTs could be double. They could even be 50%. So you're able to hire probably four to even five SDRs per SDR you have here in the US. And that's where, if you're early stage, right, you want that momentum, because you're making the gamble that five people who are properly ran up, who are great quality employees, are going to be able to produce more than your one US SDR. For people who are hiring SDR teams for the first time, if you don't get the SDR hire right, you're setting your company back 6 months. If you only have budget for one SDR or two SDRs and they don't pan out, you're in a hole. But when you hire more, let's say five of them, then it turns into the process, you get a lot more data and you're able to figure out, okay, is it my hiring process that doesn't work? Here's five people I've onboarded. This is what I'm observing.
That's a really great point. It kind of goes beyond just the fact that you can hire a few people for the price of one, but also your learnings are accelerated because it's as if you've hired five people. Well, you've hired five people where you would have hired one. You would have had that 3 to 4 month ramp period, full capacity by around month five. And only then are you gathering your learnings. And only then you've got a sample size of one, a data set from one person. So that's an incredible kind of argument for hiring abroad, especially on a sales team, especially on an outbound sales team where your success comes from this ability to experiment and to look into the data, derive insights from the data, and then pivot and make changes. Yeah, that's an incredible point. But yeah, I think that's super important to note, especially for you guys listening that are in the sales world. It's great to hire abroad in any role, but especially in a sales role where you are looking to learn as quickly as you are.
Yeah, and the learnings aren't not just from like the results that you get and the number of meetings. It's also helping you become a better manager, right? If you're a first-time founder or you're first-time in a manager position, being able to work with people abroad is one of the best lessons I can give you, right? Because mm-hmm. you don't go into the office with them. Your communication, you're going to have to over-communicate. I think that's always a good thing. So being able to have your one-on-ones, being able to talk about sales strategy, deal strategy. These are all things that are great to be able to test really early on. And if you can't mm-hmm. do it remotely, you're probably going to have less success doing it in person as well.
Yeah, absolutely. It forces you to be crystal clear on your strategy, on exactly what you want to be communicating, on exactly what you want from people. Yeah, because you're kind of having to communicate it and then the people go and do it. Whereas if you're all in the same office, you can maybe like halfway through the day, try something new, or you can like share little tips and tricks. But it forces you to be so much more intentional with your communication if you're doing it remotely. And that's even just all of us right now working in the same, location, but remotely. But there's even another layer added to that if you're also working against a cultural barrier or working to communicate in a style that makes sense for these people in a different culture as well.
Yeah, Sarah, you've nailed it. In the office, right? Let's say you say an offhanded comment and the person, and you type it on Slack and they go and execute. You can always pull them back midday and say, whoa, what were you doing? What happened there? And they're like, oh, well, you said let's go after this customer and let's use this strategy and this cadence. And when you're working remote, right, like you said, you got to be crystal clear on what your ideas are so they're better fleshed out. And I think anytime that you're clear on what you want to do, it can just impact the entire team. And you learn that through a remote workforce.
Yeah. Absolutely. Okay. I want to dig into kind of the cultural differences and how to manage these teams in a little bit. But first, I want to think from the beginning. So we're a US or North American based company, and now we're looking to expand our team into a country like India. Let's say it's the sales team for the purposes of this experiment here. So what are we looking for when we're looking to hire in India versus when we're looking to hire for the same role in the US?
Yeah. So from an operational standpoint, I would go on Upwork. I would go on Indeed. I'd go on LinkedIn and I would just post a job description in India and in whatever city that you decide, right? If you want to do Bangalore, awesome. Then when either if you're working with an HR firm, recruiting firm, or you're doing it yourself directly, the interview that you're really looking for is the same things that you are in the US. You're looking for behavioral traits, right? Past success, how have they handled different situations? You're looking for communication skills, written skills as well, right? How are they communicating via email? Are they on time to their interviews? Did they follow up? Are they sending you a thank you message on LinkedIn afterwards? So none of that changes and none of that criteria changes. The only thing that really changes is during the interview process, adapting what you feel like is important, personal goals, and important personal, let's say, achievements, and tailoring that to the local market.
Okay. So what does that look like at, we'll say, for India?
Yeah. So let's say I have a fresh college person out of my local university. I ask them about leadership. I ask them about how they are familiar with reaching out to cold outbound prospects, and they might tell me, oh, I worked at my local church organization, we had a call list, we had to fundraise, right? That makes sense mm-hmm. to me. For India, things are a little bit different there, right? It's stuff like getting involved in the community. And what does that look like? When you're at college, what is the programs you took and what do you do in those programs? I think here in the US, we are a little or advantaged in, we can do a lot of things for our community. And it's not mm-hmm. as, college isn't just academics and studying. For India, a lot of it is, right? It's the grades you get, it's the school that you graduate from. So for India, when I ask people, I ask them to talk about their personal lives and some personal projects that they worked on. And that typically gives me a insight into some of those maybe undefinable traits that I'm looking for.
Okay, cool. So you've got to kind of expand what types of things you're looking at from their experience to gather the behavioral knowledge that you're looking for. You know that you want somebody for an SDR role that's like coachable, adaptable, has a sense of urgency. I don't know. All these things that we know we're looking for in an SDR are the same regardless of where we're hiring them, but how we uncover that information about an individual is different depending on where they come from because of the types of opportunities that they have had to demonstrate those skills in their past.
Perfectly put. Yeah. Like someone who plays collegiate sports, we might identify as coachable, right? Sure. That typically doesn't happen in India. Ask them about their family and mm-hmm. what events have they put on for their community. Things like that you're trying to find similarities.
Yeah, makes sense. And how do you feel about the necessity, or do you feel that there is a necessity for past sales experience? Like, we're talking about experience that demonstrates that they're coachable, that they have great communication, that kind of stuff. But does it have to be strictly sales for them to be kind of a good person to bring on board?
Yeah, for us, we do look for someone who has been traditionally trained either in school, that they're a business major, that they have done some sort of sales, whether that's on the phone, calling, or just an interest of being able to generate revenue. So I think that is one difference that here in the US, we might look for a lot of different criteria. We can take people and mold them really quickly. I think for India, we do look for more of a traditional sales background because some of those communication skills like emailing, communicating effectively through phone and meetings, that's important to us.
Cool. That's really interesting. And that's, yeah, that was something that I was curious to learn from you if you did feel that way. Cause yeah, I know that it's common for like a US-based company might bring on an individual straight out of college who doesn't necessarily have to have studied business. But we can, you know, take a look at their past and what they've done and say like, okay, we think we could make this person into a good SDR. But why do you think it is the case that you do need to make sure that that person has the sales experience? You mentioned kind of like the ability to write business emails or kind of communicate using maybe business jargon, but what are some of the other reasons that you think it's necessary for those people that you're hiring abroad to come with some of that experience for that role that they're being hired for?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think because we want to mitigate the risk. For us, there is a large candidate pool, and the sales function in India is one where it's pretty defined, right? I think in the US, you can bring a lot of people who didn't know they wanted to be an SDR and in sales and bring them into sales. I think in India, based on how like the career paths are laid out, people who want to be in sales know that they want to be in sales, and there's a big candidate pool there. And so when we see a candidate have that background, we know that their motivation is there to learn and improve. And for us, because they are remote, they're a little bit harder, we do want to mitigate that risk in terms of what their motivations are and where they see themselves in their career path.
Right. Interesting. Okay. Totally makes sense. Okay. Let's talk more about kind of what, so something you mentioned to me offline is that in India, the way they kind of demonstrate a history of emergence or improvement in past roles is through their resume. It's all through like a job title, increasing, you know, like moving up the hierarchy within a company, moving up the pecking order. So how, talk to me more about that. I think that's kind of an interesting topic.
Yeah. Resumes and job titles are big. And a lot of that has to do with, I think, how other companies view their value. So the SDR function in India has not been like a popular one. When people see that you've been an SDR for 4 or 5 years, they think, well, why haven't you become an AE? Why haven't you become a sales manager? And there's a little bit of that stigma here in the US as well. But it's getting a lot better. That companies are hiring for senior SDRs and paying them a lot of money. So I think for India, how we deal with that is we say, hey, you're going to start with this job description. This is your job title. In 6 months or a year, it's going to change to this if you hit these goals. And we continually give them a path forward where their job titles do improve and they show growth. So if they do end up going to a different organization or even stay within and want to switch places, they can show that progress that they've made.
Cool. So you're showing them in the hiring process, you're kind of letting people know what the path would be to success within the company. And that's kind of one of the ways that you are appealing to these Indian candidates.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense. Cool. So we've talked about some of the kind of differences in terms of hiring and what you're looking for in the role or how you kind of pull out the information that you're looking to learn about a candidate. In terms of, building this team, before we dive into like actually managing the teams and the culture, what do you think are some things that people need to look out for? What are some things that somebody building a team, looking now to span a couple of continents, looking to build that second team over in India, what are some things that they need to look out for when building this team?
I think the number one is trust. If you have a conversation with that person and for some reason you aren't eager to look forward to continuing the conversation, it's probably not a good fit. If the topics that they're bringing up is interesting to you and you want to have a longer conversation with them, I think that's a big one that you look for, because trust is so important when you're working remote and even more important when it's a different country. You need to have that extra sense, and people judge that on different ways. It could be sales knowledge and they like the same books that they read. But whatever you're looking for, where you fully trust the individual, I would say that's number one. For me, I think when I'm on a call with people and they can be more genuine, they're taking off that facade of this is a job interview and they're fully transparent. And I get the sense that they are, that's when I really like a candidate and I can trust the things they're saying. So try to get them to shed the shield of like, an interview and mm-hmm. get them to talk more at a personal level. And I think this happens for remote candidates a lot, where there is like, they know they're preparing for an interview with a US based company. They might even overhype it in their brain and they act too professional, and they get nervous and their answers are kind of textbook and what they want you to hear instead of just having a normal conversation. So trying to bring that level down to what is it going to be like to work with this person on day to day, not just hearing what they say at an interview, is really, really important. And you got to be able to do that for each one of your interviews.
So how do you recommend that an interviewer help break down that barrier and kind of get the more personal stuff out of this candidate who probably has been trained to be very professional in an interview? So you're sort of working against some of their training and some of their instincts, even about interviewing for a US company. So how do you show them that they can kind of like get rid of that and get down into more personal stuff?
Yeah, I think it happens when you ask personal questions and you share personal questions as well. Mm. Not just asking things that are on their resume and saying, okay, well, I saw you put this on your resume, you put that, and saying, hey, I saw your resume. I read it beforehand. It looks great. I have a few questions, but let me touch upon the things that I really care about, which is you mentioned in your personal life that you did this. Tell me a little bit about times when you had leadership behavioral questions and say, don't relate it to work, don't relate it to academics, but just times where you personally have done something like that.
Right.
And when you get them talking about their personal life and you're able to share about your personal life, I think it takes that from that business, I'm in a business interview, suit and tie, to more of a personal connection.
Cool. And another thing I'm really curious to hear your perspective on, the SDR role is, it requires a very specific set of skills. We've mentioned a few of the top ones being like, you've got to have drive, you've got to be coachable, all these things, but there's something in there around kind of the where somebody sits on like the sociability scale. Like you want somebody who can make cold calls and face rejection and just take it on the chin and keep going. And I find that that skill is a very interesting one to balance with who we would call like a culture fit. Somebody that we feel would be a great person to have around. We'd have fun working with them all day. And I'm not saying that like the ideal SDR is somebody like antisocial and that we don't want to work with all day, but there is a bit of a balance there. That I think, especially in modern startups, we are very concerned with culture. We want to build a great culture. We want everybody to enjoy working together. And I think we often can build teams of maybe people that are very similar to us because we think like, great, we're going to get along like a house on fire. So that's the person that I want to bring onto the team. But it doesn't necessarily mean that they have the skills necessary for such a tough role. The SDR role is hard. It's like, it's filled with rejection. It's tough. This is actually something that a recent podcast guest of ours, Dirk Van Rien, and he talks about the behavioral interviewing of an SDR, the type of person that is suited to be an SDR. Other people may want to be an SDR. They may be motivated by the idea of the role, by the money, by whatever, but it doesn't matter how much you want it. If you're not kind of the behavioral fit for that role, it's going to be super stressful for you to do. And you're not going to be feeling that it's like the right role for you, kind of fighting against it. So how do you balance bringing somebody on that's a great culture fit? They're fun. They get along with you and other people interviewing with the person that's going to need to be able to like take that rejection and like bang out these cold calls.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. For us, it's pretty simple. We're really transparent in what success looks like in the company. And we don't differentiate between US and India. They have the same goals. They have the same KPIs. And for us, we say, hey, when we give you an offer here, here's our expectations. And if you don't hit those benchmarks within a given time period, we're going to put you on a PIP and we're going to offer you a severance package if you decide to leave, right?
Cool.
That part is purely performance wise. So when we do make these offers and interviews, we tell them that this is our criteria, these are our goals. And during the interview process, we also do some things like have them do some exercises, do a little bit of role play. But in order for people to hit their numbers, we do tell them that up front. And so they know what success looks like.
Right. So it's very important that you have a very clear idea of what benchmarks need to be hit by month one, month two, month three, and onward. And then that's it. That's just sort of those are just the rules. That's people adhere to that. And then there's no kind of variation on that. It's just, we know exactly what we're looking for by this month. We're going to give you everything we can to enable you to hit that goal. And if you can't hit that goal, it's not a fit.
Correct. Correct.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Cool. Let's get into the kind of managing on an ongoing basis, these teams. So we've built the team, we've got the kind of the team, the sales team that's spanning two continents. It's probably got one manager or one team of managers that are managing them all. Tell me about how you manage this team spanning the two continents.
I think the most important thing that anyone can do when managing a team that's on a different continent is time. I think Simon Sinek said it best when he said, like, time is the one resource that is equivalent, and it makes people feel like they're important. If your team is in India and they're working US hours, it's about an 11 to 12 hour difference depending on daylight savings time, here, at least in the Pacific standard time. So our team works from about 8 p.m. to about 2 or 3 a.m. in the morning their time.
Yeah.
Which means you got to be respectful of what that looks like for them, right? Most of their family's asleep. They're working the night shifts compared to your day shifts. Which means that try to spend as much time with them as possible. if you have your one-on-ones, continue to have those one-on-ones and sometimes do it on an opposite time. So we'll have weeks where all the sales meetings are in the morning so they can attend. And then we'll also have some sales meetings and all hands at night as well to accommodate for their schedule. And I think if you have that balance and you show that you as a manager are able to meet them on their times some of the time and still have those one-on-ones, it builds a lot of trust and communication that they aren't just a secondary team to your primary team. Right. I think that's the biggest thing, is making sure it's that they don't feel like they're the secondary team and the core team's here, is that it's one team together.
Yeah, absolutely. You're not favoring the US team in terms of time, in terms of, you know, both time on the clock and actual amount of hours that you spend with them. I think that's a really important thing that you've brought up there, like showing them that they are equal to, they're part of the company. It just so happens that they are based somewhere else. So what are some other ways that you can, you know, demonstrate that for a team? How else can you kind of bridge that gap or break down those potential feelings that they may be secondary?
And this is the things where you got to be meticulous in your planning for social events as well. When we have happy hours and we have games and events and even all hands, we make sure to time it so that they can attend, and we prioritize for that too. Speaking about culture, right? It's not just us sharing current events here, what's happening in the US, but reading into culture events that are happening in India as well and having them share. And when they share a big subject, let's say this cricket game is happening and you don't know, right? Taking the time to go do some research, have some questions, and prepare to have those conversations that isn't just for leading a project or getting work done, but finding similarities at a personal level with them. I think the same thing you would do with your coworkers, right? If there's something that they're really into, read up on it, ask them about it. Same thing for your team in India, right? Get to know who they are as people.
Cool. Makes sense. What about managing the actual employees working together? So we've talked about how you as a manager can kind of set things up so that everyone is, you know, working together on the same hours and you're accommodating everybody equally. But what about the employee to employee, like Indian employee versus or to US employee relationship? How do you kind of foster a good one there?
Yeah, it's a great question. For that, I would say if you as a leadership team treat them like your real team, then whatever new employees you bring on will also treat them like their respectable member who's been at the company for a long time, especially when the metrics and dashboards are out there. So our top SDR, you know exactly how many meetings he's booked. When we record calls, everybody can go and find his library of recorded calls, and his credentials speak for himself. When we bring on new SDRs here in the US and they review those calls and they see how great someone sounds, they see those bookings happen and they go look at their numbers, that's enough for them to be a believer to say, hey, even though I'm in the US and I was hired as a US SDR, this person is a lot I can learn from at the company. And there's proof of that. It's not just my team telling me, yeah, these people are great because they've been here for a long time, but I'm finding all the resources, I'm listening to their meetings, and I feel like there's something I can learn. And we encourage our teams to communicate, right? To Slack each other, to call each other on video chat. We have work blocks where everybody gets together and gets to work together. But that's how we do it.
Nice. So your job kind of as a leader is to highlight whatever reps are doing well, like highlight the good things, highlight the successes, and make them visible and available to everybody. So make sure that you've got those banks of recorded calls for everybody to listen to, make sure that everybody can see each other's metrics so that you know kind of the benchmark, the highest numbers that are being hit and who exactly is hitting them. And then you know that that's a person that you can go to learn from, for advice, that kind of stuff.
And I think nothing is more motivating than when you sit in on a power hour session and you have a team in India where sometimes the internet is spotty and they're making calls and they have an accent and they're still booking meetings. And you're sitting over here with your perfect microphone, like they have better microphones, better Comcast internet. Sometimes they're in the office. And it gives you that more sense of confidence that, hey, if they can do it with the resources that they have, like I can definitely do it as well. And we really like to showcase that.
Yeah. Yeah. And if they can do it, it means the strategy is strong, that the scripts are good. You're reaching out to the right people. It's sort of indicative of, yeah, success on kind of every front.
Exactly. Exactly.
Cool. How interesting. Cool. Anything else that you think kind of on the cultural front or on the managing, whether it's the relationships between the two sides of your employees or yeah. Anything else that you'd want to share with people about how to manage the everyday of two different, a team spanning two continents?
I think when you're having one-on-ones, you'll notice that a lot of people here in the US look for collaborative work environments. Mm-hmm. It's just something that's been ingrained in our society, Canada as well, right? Is that you want to, in the Western countries, you want to work with a collaborative team. And so you get a lot of feedback from your direct reports and or team. And sometimes it's unsolicited, sometimes they'll bring it up, right? But they are empowered to give feedback because they want to feel empowered, and that's awesome. In India and other parts of the world where they're not brought up on Western education, it's very hierarchical.
Hierarchical?
Yeah, there we go. Where they're almost like waiting for you to give them instructions. Mm-hmm. And a big part of that is you got to empower them to voice up their opinions. Mm-hmm. And then not shut them down when it does happen, right? To encourage that behavior. When my SDRs first started, they would only say okay, and they never brought up complaints. And for a while, I thought I was doing a great job. I was like, wow, my strategy is awesome. Everything they yeah. do is great. And it wasn't until one of my SDRs told me that, and he had worked in the US before and went back and said, hey, like this is just, they're not going to say no to you because you're the boss, right?
Yeah.
And that's when I began to shift my tone of saying, okay, how do I really dig into what's working or not? Mm-hmm. And how do I get them to voice their opinions? And you do that through having them talk about something and backing them up and saying, hey, there's a lot of great points. Let's keep talking about this, and doing it in a group setting where their voice is heard. And I think that's one thing that's really important if you are going to develop a team in India, is getting people to voice their opinions to empower them as well.
Mm-hmm. So how do you get them to do that for the first time? Like how do I understand that, like once somebody is willing to share their point of view on something, you've got to encourage it to make sure that they know that that's a great thing to do and that opinion is valued. But how do you like break that initial barrier and get them to do it for the first time? Like show them that that's what you want and show them that it's okay to do it for the first time.
And this one I took from a chapter in Radical Candor, where I sat down with them on an interview, a one-on-one, and I said, I want you to give me feedback on what I can do to make it easier to work with you and make your job easier. The first meeting, they're like, oh, nothing, like everything's great. The second meeting, I said, hey, you need to have something. I need you to tell me something by the next time we meet. And this is very, very important. And getting them to provide feedback on your working style can start having them give feedback on the organization. That's the first, right? And when they give me feedback in terms of how I communicate on Slack or through email or what I can do more effectively during one-on-ones, that starts to open up that communication, especially if you take it seriously, right? One of the SDRs was saying, I don't find this meeting effective, right? And here's the reasons why. And I said, well, let's work together and make this meeting more effective. Should we even have it? Is the time length correct? And when they see that you take their feedback seriously, and it just doesn't come in one ear and go out the other, then they're willing to give and provide more feedback.
Yeah, makes sense. So you're almost like bending to the way that they're used to being managed initially by saying like, almost like, okay, you're used to hearing commands top down. My command is give me feedback bottom up. That's the first way to do it. And then of course, once they start doing it, to encourage that, show them that you're taking everything that they say into account and working with them on solutions rather than just, you know, dictating what they're supposed to do and then leaving them to do it on their own.
Yeah, absolutely.
Awesome. That's so interesting. It's so interesting, of course, for us, because, for me, having just moved into SDR management, my team is based in Mexico. So this is all absolutely very top of mind. I'm sure you could tell that some of the questions were just genuinely from, you know, my own experience. And it's so interesting to hear from somebody with so much experience of working with a company that, or a sales team that does span two continents. Of course, in my case, same continent, but same rules apply. So yeah,
Sarah, actually a question for you then. Have you noticed any similarities between what we said during this episode and kind of what you're experiencing? And also, are there any differences that you've observed from your team too? I'd love to hear your experience.
Absolutely. A ton of similarities. So I'm thinking back, I'm trying to backtrack so that we kind of stay in some kind of order. I'm not hopping all over the place. In terms of culture, I'll start with culture because culture is always obviously the, well, it's the obvious one that comes up when we think about different places. There seems to be a similarity in terms of the value of a title or the value of hierarchy, I think. It really resonated with me what you said about when you're interviewing, you can't necessarily look for the same things that you would look for on a US resume. You've kind of got to like pull out the behavioral things that you're looking for by looking in new places. That is something that I'm definitely going to take into account right away. And then absolutely the back to hierarchy, showing a path to growth, I think is something that the SDRs really value. It's something that people value in the US too, but it seems to like, I don't know, it sort of like presents itself in a different way. And I don't really know how to describe the difference, but for sure, like people in the US want to grow. They don't come in and say like, I'm going to be an SDR and I can't wait to be an SDR for the next 30 years. They're coming in and they're hoping to go somewhere else after that. And it's absolutely the case with the Mexico team as well. But there's like a little difference there in kind of, I think also there's a bit, they don't necessarily want to share with you in the interview process right away that they are looking for growth. Whereas a US candidate would be completely happy to tell you that they have aspirations of being a manager. But I think, and maybe it's because of kind of the authority, the structures of authority that exist in these other cultures, but they feel maybe that they're like not grateful for the position they have if they express that they want the growth, yet at the same time, growth is very important to them. So it's like this funny dichotomy where the title means a lot to them, but they don't want you to think that they are like reaching above their station or something like that. So it's a really interesting one to manage coming, as you mentioned, from Canada, from the US, where we've got like all these opportunities afforded to us. We are taught through the education system to be like outspoken and confident and that we can like have whatever we want and we can ask it and we can like walk up to a CEO and tell them whatever we want to tell them. And that's totally fine. And that's not taught in other places. So you absolutely have to learn how to like shift the conversation or shift your perspective to like, I'm still working it out. I've only been doing this for a couple of months, but I'm still working out how to kind of, you know, triangulate and get to, yeah, get to a place where we have the same trust, where they do feel that they can speak to me as I would feel comfortable speaking to Colin Stewart and Aaron Ross, and asking for what I want or sharing something that's not working. But a lot of what you shared is really, really valuable. And I'm definitely going to be taking it right after we finish this podcast, taking it into account.
Yeah, I think I also had the challenge of when they're first on the phone, they're really apologetic. They want to thank prospects for their time and just be overly polite, like a big favor is being done, instead of coming in with bravado and saying, this is me, this is the world, we have a great product, this is why I want to help you out.
Absolutely.
And then I think, I know time's almost up, but the one thing I wanted to share, I forgot this, but I think it's even more important than all the tips I gave, which is, it's not just you who needs to give them time, but the organization itself, right? Mm. There's a lot of meaning when a CEO is willing to dedicate time to meet with your team to answer questions. And I think our CEO and CEO do a fantastic job where because we give them opportunities where it's just them, the CEO, and they're presenting projects they're working on in progress to the CEO. Mm-hmm. It's not just me that's saying, hey, I'm giving you a lot of time, I appreciate this, but the whole organization, and the higher up you can go, the better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that totally makes sense. showing them that they've got the same kind of lines of communication or the same avenue to the top, the senior leadership, as everyone else does, maybe who's in the same geography. Yeah, makes sense. Yeah. And just to touch on what you said there about being apologetic on the phone, absolutely. Like literally what you just said is exactly what a lot of the SDRs in Mexico feel. And I think it comes back again to this sort of Western entitlement sounds negative, but we have like a confidence and we feel that we are entitled to having a conversation with whoever we like. And again, it's not a negative entitlement, but it is what it is. Yeah. And I think, yeah, there's like, okay, I'm reaching out to, you know, like the CFO of Procter & Gamble. I better be, you know, I better be nice. I better show that I know that he's, you know, important and that I value his time and blah, blah, blah. Whereas I think, yeah, Canadians and Americans have an easier time understanding like, okay, no, we're coming in and providing something of value. So rather, we almost take the opposite approach where we're like, no, they should be thanking me because I'm going to save them so much time and so much money and, you know, all these things. Of course, we don't take it that far, but there is really that difference in perspective there. And it's so interesting that you find exactly the same thing with your team.
Yeah. And I think everything you said is correct. And the reason why in our jobs as leaders is to show them that, hey, there's your way of doing it. And there's also this way of doing it. Try it out, right? Explore, see what confidence does. And I think, as you know, confidence on the phone is the best thing you can do to increase mm-hmm. your numbers.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, awesome. Thank you so much for sharing your perspective on managing this multi-continental team. It's been really incredible having you. If people want to learn more from you, if they want to hear more about this particular topic, where can they get in touch with you?
You can always connect with me on LinkedIn. It's just LinkedIn. You can look up Billy Sheng, Sheng. I love helping communities, entrepreneurs, anyone who wants to get started. Shoot me a message. And you can also email me at billy@esper.io as well.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much again, Billy. And yeah, can't wait to see where your team goes and how much bigger it is by the next time I speak to you.
Yeah. And hopefully we get to stay in touch because I'd love to hear about your team as well. Thanks, Sarah, for the time.
Absolutely. I had a great time. And thank you guys for listening to another episode of the Predictable Revenue Podcast. See you next time.